on Marquette.
Her face had lost color.
He made me stay. I was terrified. Went to the bedroom and waited until he was done. It was horrible. I was paralyzed by anxiety.
Stockholm syndrome.
It's mental torture, she said. I've had a severely chronic case for a long, long time, even before I met Paul. Men were abusing me.
Hollick Wilde looked at me again.
Some people think of it as a particularly severe variant of PTSD.
Milo said,
How long have you been afflicted, Tricia?
Since I was a girl, she said. I was abused. A lot more since Paul.
Paul scared you.
He scared me out of my mind.
Because of what he did to Jackie.
Tricia Bowker blinked and folded her lips inward.
Hollick Wilde said, Let's stay away from that, Milo. Can I ask if there were other victims besides Jackie?
Bowker's eye shift was the answer. The search would continue. Wilde said,
Sorry, please, no. I'd rather we stick to the case at hand.
Fair enough,
said Milo. He shuffled papers.
All these rules, you may need to guide me as I proceed.
Happy to.
Tricia Bowker's posture relaxed. Everyone getting along so well. Milo had her go over the details again. She produced a nearly word-for-word version of her first account.
Got the picture, he said. Here's something relevant to the case at hand, Mr. Wilde.
Smiling at the lawyer.
Wilde said, Relevance always good.
Stupidest thing I've heard from the lips of a defense attorney. He gave Bowker a go-ahead nod. Milo said,
Trish, if I told you we found Mr. Braun's hands buried in the backyard of the Marquette house under an oleander bush, what would you say?
Multiple blinks. Rightward roll of her body. A sailor accommodating a big wave.
Trish?
I'd say that's good. I'd say I'm glad. Now you see what Paul's capable of.
Scary guy.
Terrifying.
Stockholm syndrome.
Okay, now, if I told you, Trish, that the skin on top of the hands we found buried in the Marquette backyard had your DNA on it, what would you say?
She half rose, sank back down.
That's impossible.
I'm afraid it's more than possible, Trish. It's actual. The pathologist found your DNA in little half-moon indentations on the top of the hand, most likely from nails being dug in.
No way, she said. Paul must have put them there.
He took the time to put your hand on top of Mr. Braun's hand and dug you in?
No, 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 I never... He figured out a way.
Her head shook hard enough to inflict whiplash. Wilde said,
I think we should...
Bowker shot out of her chair.
He made me! He would have killed me!
Those nail marks, Tricia, tells me you were angry.
No, terrified! He would have cut me up, too!
Milo said,
Speaking of cutting, we also found your fingerprints on the bandsaw in the garage.
That's 'cause he made me use it.
To cut off Hargis Braun's hands.
It wasn't... He was already dead.
Hollick Wilde said,
Sorry, guys, interview terminated.
Tricia Bowker pretended to cry.
Wilde said, Hang in.
How can I? They don't understand.
We'll get them to see the light,
said Wilde. But his face was dark. By nightfall, Wilde had come up with an offer. In return for revealing where Jacqueline Mearsheim's body was buried, Bowker would plead to accessory to manslaughter after the fact and a 3-year sentence. John Nguyen laughed. The following morning, Wilde proposed accessory to second-degree murder before the fact and a 10-year sentence. John Nguyen proposed 25 to life. Wild tried 15. Nguyen said, "I can go with 15 to 25, but in the end it'll be up to the judge." Wild said, "Okay." To Milo, Nguyen confided, "I'll get Friedman. She'll get life." Chapter 52. Even with Tricia Bowker's hand-drawn map, it took a while. After 2 days of searching, Jacqueline Mearsheim's partial skeleton was found under 4 feet of rich agricultural soil in the Santa Ynez Mountains above Santa Barbara. Private land, the failed vineyard of a music industry honcho who'd long given up on Pinot Noir. Getting his permission had involved calling the Cayman Islands. Per Bowker's self-cleansing account, she and Mearsheim had visited a nearby winery during a weekend when Jackie languished in bed with the flu. Spotting the abandoned estate, Paul had made a mental note and returned months later at night with her body in the trunk of his car. Entering the estate by snipping barbed wire, then digging unmolested near a windbreak of blue gum eucalyptus. Unable to get Bowker to talk about additional victims, Milo called Sheila Braxton and gave her the basics. She said, "Time to look at all the missings around here. How's he doing?"
"Well as can be expected."
"Give him my best. Maybe I'll come by to see him."
Milo and I updated Corey Thurber, still hospitalized at Cedars-Sinai 4 days after his rescue. Rick Silverman had been off duty the night Corey was ambulanced to the ER, but Milo's call brought him in. He tended to the boy's immediate health issues and called in a hand surgeon to see what could be done for Corey's mangled fingers. Milo said, "He's a piano player." The surgeon said, "Fuck," and walked away. This morning, Corey was able to talk through cracked lips, his hand a bandaged mitt. Milo introduced me.
"Someone thinks I'm crazy?"
Milo explained. Corey said,
"Okay,"
but he avoided looking at me.
"So," said Milo, "anything you feel like telling us?"
"What I told you yesterday," said Corey. "She's the one who did it."
Milo said,
"She hit you with a hammer."
"She laughed while she was doing it," said the boy,
amazed, as if reciting a weird factoid.
"He taped me up and held me down, but she hit me. She was laughing. He was a pussy. That's why she killed him."
"Because he was
a total pussy," said Corey Thurber. "She gave him the shotgun, told him to shoot me. He said, 'Not again.' She started yelling at him."
His eyes shut.
"After she hit me like 2 times, 3, I passed out. When I woke, I was
staring at the mitt. When brown irises reappeared, I said, 'What was she yelling about?'"
"He had to shoot me. He was saying if it was so easy, she should do it. The last time made him sick. They must have gone into another room because the yelling got softer, but it kept on. Then she said, 'Where the fuck do you think you're going?' Then there was this noise."
"What kind of noise?"
"Something hitting the floor," said Corey. "Like a person. Then it got quiet, and she came in all covered with blood. I thought she was going to come in and shoot me, but she didn't have no gun. She kept saying, 'Fuck.' Then the door knocked, and she left, and she was talking to someone else."
"That was us, Corey."
"Good."
The boy's eyelids fought gravity, lost. He stayed asleep. Chapter 53. 2 days later, I sat by Corey's bed in the surgical unit, polishing a custody report on my iPad as I waited for him to emerge from anesthesia. The first of many operations had ended an hour ago. Results were as well as can be expected, per the surgeon. She was donating her services. So was Rick. The hospital was working with Medi-Cal to recoup whatever it could. By 3:15, Corey's eyes had cleared. A few minutes later, he focused on me and managed a nod. I'd been in and out of the room yesterday, pouring water and soda for him, avoiding anything remotely therapeutic. It's what I taught my interns and fellows when I worked oncology. Patients whose diagnosis isn't psychiatric hate anything shrinky, so don't make matters worse and just be a nice person. By day's end, Corey had relaxed. Now he gave a goofy smile, licked parched lips. I went over and held a cup of water to his barely open mouth. He croaked, cleared his throat. Moments later, "Thanks, Doc." His eyes closed and opened. "You're here a lot. Have a lot of time?" "For you, I do." "Because I'm screwed up?" "Because you've been through hell, and I want to help." "That's why you did the GoFundMe?" "That was Lieutenant Sturgis's idea." "It came in super fast," he said, "after that big donation in the beginning."
"Part of this year's tax deductions." I said, "People see it as a worthy cause, Corey."
All the time since my mom disappeared, only a few people have been cool with me. Like Miss Etta. Without her."
Trying to raise his hand, he failed and winced. I said, "More water?"
Don't want to be bratty, Doc, but I'd kind of like 7-Up.
"What a demanding guy," I said, reaching for the can. He smiled. Half a cup of soda later, he was talking.
"I always knew he did it. I thought from the way the police were that they knew, but they never admitted it. Probably figured I was a stupid kid. I shouldn't know. But I knew. I wanted to go up and tell I knew, but I was scared shitless. He left anyway. That made me happy, even though I didn't know what was going to happen to me by myself. You know what happened, right, Doc?"
"You got put in fosters."
"A lot of them. That was okay. I told myself to stop thinking about it. About Mom. I stopped for a while. Then I couldn't. Especially when I was older, working, the thoughts just kept coming back. Like songs would do that, like opening up a window in my brain. I got angry. Went looking and found where he was."
"How did you do that, Corey?"
"It wasn't so hard, Doc. He used to work for the school district doing computer stuff. So I called, said I was his son, just got out of the army, was away for a long time in Iraq, needed to find him. I lied about that because it was part true. I tried to join the army, even the Coast Guard, but there was something with my spine, a fused bone. So I used that and they looked him up and said he'd transferred to the school district in L.A. I called them and told them the same thing."
Pushing lank, pale hair off a pimpled forehead. "I added another lie. I'd been shot in Iraq. They gave me the address."
"On Evada Lane?"
"Yeah. The other one I found by following him."
A glance at his damaged hand.
"Maybe that's why it happened, huh?
Lie about a bad thing that doesn't happen, and you get one that does happen?"
I said, "I could get all moralistic with you, Corey, but I seriously doubt that."
"You don't believe in karma?"
"Not literally."
"How do you believe in it?"
"Sometimes the things we do bring direct consequences. Sometimes stuff just happens.
And people get away with it."
"I'm afraid they do, Corey."
He looked at his empty cup. I poured soda and helped him drink. When he finished, he let out a puff of air, then a burp.
Excuse me. It actually doesn't hurt that bad.
Probably the dope they put me on.
A beat.
I never did real dope, just some weed. Like when I was playing at the Carpenter, there was all kinds of pills and shit around. I never did that. Didn't want to screw up my playing.
The other musicians offered.
How'd you know?
I used to play in a band, went through the same thing.
When?
When I was about your age.
Before you were a doctor?
Way before, to make money to pay for college.
Piano?
Guitar.
Huh. So you never fooled with dope either?
A little weed.
He grinned.
That's acceptable.
I said, so you got the address on Nevada and began watching him.
I got it, but I chicken shitted out of going up to him. It was this real nice neighborhood, a lot nicer than where we ever lived. That seemed so totally wrong. He was a rich guy, and Mom was...
He looked away.
I got kind of a hollow feeling. Drove back to Santa Barbara feeling like a total loser. For a long time, I thought about doing a bad thing. I always chicken shitted out. Smoked weed, not gonna lie to you, also beer. Trying not to feel, you know?
Sure.
But I still felt, Doc, shitty and like a loser and tired. At night I played at the Carpenter and other bars. During the day I had nothing to do, so I hung out on the beach, slept in the Camaro. Is it okay, the Camaro?
Safe and sound, I said. After being gone over with an LAPD technical comb. You mind if it gets a wash and wax?
Big smile. Sure. The tags?
Taken care of.
Wow, he said.
So you hung at the beach?
Always liked the beach, especially when there wasn't a lot of people around. Sometimes down in Carpinteria or Oxnard, sometimes back in the city near Stern's Wharf. Mom used to take me there. We'd go up to the pier, have fried shrimp, look at the sea lions.
Brown eyes filmed. I said, Stern's is where you met Hal.
Yeah. He was also hanging out, sitting on a blanket. I was sitting on sand. I thought he was a pervert because when I looked at him, he smiled. But he didn't do anything pervy. Just looked at the water and drank Diet Coke. Except if he'd catch me looking, then he'd smile. I still thought he was weird. Then he got up and came over, limping, and said, "You okay, son?"
Corey grimaced.
The way he said it, like he meant it, like he could tell I was a messed-up loser, like he... I didn't want to tell him anything, but I don't know why I ended up telling him.
About your mom.
About her. About him. An evil fucker living in Pacific Palisades. He sat down next to me on the sand, listened, and didn't say nothing. When I was finished, he said, I'm no superhero, kid, but if you're scared to face him alone, I can go with you. I should have decided he's definitely a perv. But I didn't. Something about the way he... I know I could have been totally ripped off, but I guess I wasn't. So, I guess I was right.
Hal was sincere.
But I told him no thanks. He said, just putting it out there. Then I got a little mad and said, why would you do that? You don't know me. He said, yeah, it's pretty stupid and weird, but I've had my problems. I know what problems are, kid. Then he pointed to his leg. Said he'd messed it up a long time ago, couldn't work a real job, was always trying to find usefulness in his life, or something like that.
He wanted his life to be meaningful.
That's the word he used, meaningful. Everyone needed to be meaningful. I told him my meaningful was finding Mom and having the fucking devil punished. I told him I'd given up. Now it was just piano that filled in... the spaces in my brain. He said, at least you're good at one thing. Most people aren't. I'm thinking, how does he know? He never heard me. But Why argue? Someone says something nice.
He choked back a sob.
He was a great guy. I'm so sorry for what happened to him.
Not your fault.
I let him do it.
Talking to Paul was his decision, Corey.
That's all it was supposed to be, talking. What he called appealing to his humanity. I said, I don't think he has any. He said, everyone has some. So I gave him the address. He was supposed to call me after he went, but he didn't. I figured he changed his mind and never went. I got mad at him for being another bullshitter. I knew where he lived because he gave me his address, told me I could crash there if I needed. I went there to talk to him a bunch of times, but chicken shit it out. The last time I really was going to knock on his door, but there was this old guy giving me the evil eye, so I got out of there, thinking the Camaro, the tags, if the cops came, I'd lose my home.
He threw up his undamaged hand, stared at the other as if it had let him down.
It was messed up, Doc. I was angry with everyone. Then I decided, take care of your own business, dude. When I had enough gas, I went back to Pacific Palisades late at night so no one would see me. Did it a bunch of times. I'd park blocks away and walk and look at his house. I never saw much. That was the bad part of at night. Nothing can happen. Except then.
You did see something.
Nothing important. This girl from next door. She'd come out and look at the other house on the other side. Sometimes she'd smoke. Sometimes she'd just stand there. I thought she was weird.
I said, eventually you discovered the Marquette house and the cabin in Arrowhead.
Both of them were kind of connected. One night I was watching, and finally she came out. Not the girl, his new wife.
Her. Grimacing.
She came out late at night, got into the truck, and left. So I followed. I thought maybe I'd tell her about him, mess him up at least a little. I don't really know what I was thinking, Doc. I'd already spent so much time watching, and nothing happened. I felt like a loser. She drove to the other place. The place where she...
He shuddered. Limp hair swayed.
It was weird. She drove into the garage, but came right out and waited. This was like 2 in the morning. Soon after, the Range Rover showed up. I recognized it because it was from next door, where the weird girl came out of. But she wasn't driving, a guy was. I'd seen him, too, coming home in a black Uber or some kind of limo. The guy who lived there. Big. He looked like a coach.
Chet Corvin.
Didn't know his name, just that he was next door. She got into the Rover, and they left. I figured maybe I'd tell him. Your wife's doing the guy from right next door, and you don't have a clue. You're a total loser. Turns out he did have a clue, huh, Doc?
You followed them all the way to Arrowhead?
Barely made it. Barely had gas money, but I'd done a few extra gigs at the Carpenter, also a pizza place in Goleta, rich college kids. No one tipping, but I had at least some dough. When I hit San Bernardino, I needed to fill up, but I was lucky. So did they. I pulled into the same station they did. They never noticed me.
Smiling.
I'm like that. Invisible.
I'm not so sure about that, Corey.
No? Hang out with me and you'll see. I just kind of fade out.
Blushing.
I'm not being weird, Doc.
I know that. So you drove to Arrowhead.
All the way up to that pointy house. I turned my lights off for the last part of it, pretty hairy driving in the dark, except for I could see their taillights. They went into the house. His hand was on her ass. Her hand was on his pants, in front, over his dick. It was pretty obvious this was their fuck pad. I'm thinking, asshole, I'm gonna take pictures, want to see the look on your face when I tell you you're a loser. Then all of a sudden, he shows up.
Paul.
I don't even use his name. He's Mr. Evil. Yeah, him and his Taurus. He drives right past me. I was off the side of the road. It was dark under some trees. I nearly shit. What if he was there from the beginning and saw me get gas? But I guess he didn't, because he just cruised up the road and sat there looking at the house. For a long time, Doc. Then he drove away. I was freaked out. It was unreal. I called Hal, but he didn't answer. I was sure he was blowing me off. I had no idea.
No reason for you to.
You think so?
I know so, Corey.
If you say so. I got out of there, drove back to Santa Barbara, couldn't stop thinking about it. Figured my best shot was talking to her, telling her what a dick she was married to, what he did to Mom. She was in danger. His laughter began as a light, not unpleasant sound, ended up acid running down a pane of glass. That sure worked out well. I'm tired, Doc. I'm like, there's nothing inside me. I'm real tired.
Chapter 54. I pushed the call button, and a cute nurse around Corey's age came in and squirted something into his IV. He was already out, but the juice slowed his breathing. She watched him for a second, touched his arm.
He's so brave, Doctor. A real hero.
I went down to the hospital cafeteria. Milo was in a corner table eating a sandwich filled with some kind of meat and drinking a sweating glass of iced tea.
How's he doing?
Pretty well, considering.
Can you talk about it? He waived confidentiality?
He waved yesterday.
I recapped.
He said, Braun thought he could just walk up to Mearsheim and tell him to do the right thing? What the hell was that, a death wish?
Hard to say.
Is it really, Alex? Come on, it's like those do-gooders who pack up and go to the Congo or Syria or wherever hell currently is and get their heads chopped off. I'm not saying their intentions are bad, but still.
I said nothing.
He said, fine, be profoundly non-judgmental.
He drank tea, put the glass down.
I am not blaming the victim, but still, it's a death wish, right? Maybe even a type of suicide.
I got up, poured coffee from the doctor's urn, and returned. Milo said,
you look offended.
God forbid, I said, just thinking.
About?
You probably won't like my answer.
What, Alex?
People vary. There are all types of stories.
Fine, he said. We won't malign the dead. At least not the noble dead like our man Braun.
Under his breath.
Virtuous idiot.
My cell chirped. I read the window, clicked in. Felice Corvin said, Lieutenant Sturgis filled me in. I'm so glad it's over.
He's right here. We're at the hospital.
With that poor boy?
Yes.
Please give him my best, Dr. Delaware. I contributed to his fund. He's been through so much. If you were a girl, I'd say give him a kiss for me.
I'll pass along the message.
Good.
Silence.
What's up, Felice?
This might be awkward, but I'm calling about my boy. Breddy's started having problems. I knew it would happen. He's been too unemotional about Chet, losing his dad. He was the one who really loved Chet. Chet cared about him, as much as he could anyone. Anyway, Brett's having problems.
Hold on, I said. I'll go somewhere private.
Not necessary, Dr. Delaware. Lieutenant Sturgis already knows more about my family than anyone, right?
I walked away anyway.
What kind of problems? Like I told you, he cried a bit at first, but then stopped. Now it's all the time, sobbing. He thinks he's hiding it from me, but I hear it. Loud sobs when he's alone after he's gone to bed. In the morning, he's been looking ghostly, has no appetite. His schoolwork was never great, but it's gone totally to pot. He won't even pretend. And sports, his favorite thing? Forget that. No interest. He's getting gaunt, Doctor. He doesn't even torment Chelsea anymore. She's being nicer to him, but that's not it. He ignores her. Ignores me. It's like he's become this sad, old, diminished man.
She sniffled, said, "Sorry," and began sobbing. When she spoke again, her voice was a burning pile of twigs.
"So anyway, Dr. Delaware, that's the story with my Bretty. Would there be any way for you to see him? I've had so much bad luck with therapists, and you know the situation. I know I wasn't gracious when Chet tried to get you."
"Let's set up an appointment."
"Oh, great."
Sighing.
"When?"
"Sooner's better than later," I said.
"Thank you, Doctor. I can't tell you what it means to me. Is there any chance even today?"
I checked my calendar. "I can make it at 6.
"We'll be there. Thank you, thank you."
I notated the appointment. Returned to Milo. He said,
"People to do, places to meet."
"You know me, big guy. Popular."
"Bet you actually were in high school. What, a custody case?"
I said, "Another story." This is John Rubenstein. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Night Moves, an Alex Delaware novel by Jonathan Kellerman. This program was directed by Gabrielle DeQueer. Executive producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2018 by Jonathan Kellerman. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.